From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Croupier, a great new film about a writer who becomes a casino dealer and returns to the world of gambling he was born into. He's addicted to the casino but refuses to gamble. He sees himself as a detached voyeur. Spin the roulette wheel, deal the cards, and watch people lose. We'll talk to the screenwriter Paul Myersberg and its director Mike Hodges. Myersberg also wrote The Man Who Fell to Earth. Hodges' first film, Get Carter, starring Michael Caine, was number 16 in a list of the top 100 British films compiled from a poll of film professionals. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In response to the Fed's decision today to raise interest rates by a half percentage point, Texas Governor George W. Bush said he trusts Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan's judgment. Bush refused to speculate that an economic slowdown might help his campaign. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
At a campaign stop in Portland, Oregon, Bush was asked if the interest rate hike might lead to a slower economy, thereby weakening one of Vice President Al Gore's built-in advantages, the long economic boom. But Bush chose not to engage in any political analysis of the Fed's decision, and he wasn't about to be caught cheering for bad economic news.
Well, I hope the economy doesn't slow down. I want the economy to remain robust and strong. I want people to be able to find work. And I'm not a very good prognosticator about the economy, but I trust Alan Greenspan's judgment.
The vice president also avoided commenting directly on the interest rate hike. President Clinton was also circumspect, saying the Fed will do its job and the administration will follow its own policies. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Portland.
Thousands of people returned to their homes in Los Alamos, New Mexico today after a raging fire kept them away from home for more than a week. Officials said a quarter of the town remains closed and that gas and electricity may not be restored for another week. Firefighters say they've managed to contain about 35% of the 46,000-acre fire, but they're watching closely to make sure that rising winds don't cause it to spread again. The fire destroyed more than 220 structures in Los Alamos and damaged many more, leaving 400 families homeless. The Los Alamos National Laboratory remains closed. President Clinton made a little more progress today in his search for votes in favor of a bill to grant China permanent trading privileges with the U.S. The highest-ranking Democrat on the House Ways and Means Committee, Charles Rangel of New York, said he would vote yes. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Rangel is one of the highest-ranking Democrats in the House and the top Democrat on the powerful Ways and Means Committee. If the Democrats take the House back in the fall, Rangel would be the chairman. The president said that Rangel's support for permanent trade relations may help get other Democrats to vote yes.
If we're fortunate enough to get a majority of Democrats on the committee to vote for this, because of Charles Rangel's leadership and because some of the others have already come out, that surely will have an effect on our caucus, because they are in the best position to understand the economic issues involved here.
The White House still does not have the Democratic votes it needs to pass the bill when it comes up in the House next week. Organized labor, one of the Democratic Party's most important constituency groups, is lobbying hard against the bill. The president is talking one-on-one with wavering lawmakers almost every day. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 127 points to close at 10,934. The Nasdaq gained 110 points. This is NPR. A judge in Detroit has sentenced a former city police officer to 7 to 15 years in prison for the beating death of a black motorist. Larry Nevers will get credit for the 4 years he's already served in prison. Nevers was convicted of involuntary manslaughter last month in a second trial for the 1992 killing of Malice Green. Nevers and his partner, both white, said they had to use force to subdue Green, a black man, after stopping him near a suspected crack house. The officers allegedly beat Green over the head with their flashlights. Iran's hardline judiciary has launched a fresh offensive against the press. It closed another moderate daily newspaper. It also summoned the head of President Mohammad Khatami's press office. Dale Gavlak reports from Cairo.
The suspension of Hamahan newspaper brings to 13 the number of reformist dailies shut down since April. Hamahan has been charged with spreading false reports about the Islamic Republic's elite Revolutionary Guards, police, and the intelligence ministry. It was run by former Tehran mayor and Khatami ally Gholam Hossein Kharbashi. The judiciary also summoned the publisher of a new pro-reform daily, Bahar, for questioning. The publisher is the head of Khatami's press office. So far, the paper is allowed to continue printing. Since the crackdown, several new reformist papers have either been opened or are being planned. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak in Cairo.
White House correspondent Helen Thomas resigned today after nearly 40 years of covering American presidents for United Press International. Thomas, who's 79, stepped down on the news that UPI has been purchased by News World Communications, a company founded by the Reverend Sun Myung Moon. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Croupier opened in the U.S. without much advertising or publicity as part of an independent film series presented by the distribution company, The Shooting Gallery. So you may not even have heard about it, but it's gotten some great reviews. I like it so much, I've seen it three times. My guest is the screenwriter, Paul Myersberg. Croupier is the story of an unpublished writer named Jack, who, to make ends meet, takes a job as a croupier, or dealer, in a London casino. It's the world he grew up in, but has tried to stay away from. His father was a gambler, but Jack doesn't gamble. Gamblers lose. Jack says you have to make a choice in life, be a gambler or a croupier. After Jack takes the job, he decides to write a novel about a croupier. The film's dialogue is intercut with Jack's inner monologues about gambling and writing. Here are excerpts from two scenes.
Jack started to dress for the casino at home, a man in love with his uniform. Like a musician in his tuxedo going to the concert hall on public transport, eager to perform.
No more bets, thank you. 19 red.
The croupier registered disgust.
This gentleman's accidentally coughed on the chips.
The writer made a note.
Agnes.
Good scene for the book.
Take these chips off the table for me.
16. 2 minutes. 15. 2 minutes. 12. 2 minutes. 11 double. 21. Blackjack.
A wave of elation came over him. He was hooked again.
Place your bets, please.
Watching people lose.
The film Croupier is about gambling and writing, chance and coincidence, what's in your control and what's out of it. In his life as a croupier and a writer, Jack prides himself on being the detached voyeur.
The whole idea of the piece was that there is a curious detachment which exists in a croupier, apart from the, you know, basic contempt in the end for gamblers. And with the writer, in his attempt to, if you like, woo a publisher, an audience, a public. So in a way, they're both different sides of gambling. They tend to do their work in a quite lonely way. They lead very non-office hours. But above all, they're detached from what they do. In other words, in order to write, you have to pull yourself back from things. In order to be in a casino, of course, you can't gamble, so you have to detach yourself. And it's really the price you pay, or the, in relation to the possible success, of being that character. So you're a loner in two different ways. I think that was really the sense of it.
Now, I'll confess, there's a lot of gambling movies I don't particularly like, because it seems to me in a gambling movie, you know the gambler's going to lose. He's going to lose all of his money, and his friends and family will feel betrayed, and they will have lost a lot, too. Or if it's a heist film, you know, something terrible is going to happen with the heist, and everybody's going to lose there, too. And every time your film seems to be heading into one of those conventional formula gambling directions, something very surprising happens instead. It just takes a different kind of twist, which I felt terrific about.
Well, I based that on nights in the casino.
Uh-huh.
You know, you are certain a certain number must come up. You absolutely know it's been five black in a row. It has to be red. Of course, it's black. You really do not know what number is coming up. And you say, I've got a plan, I've got a scheme, I've got a system. But of course, you don't know. And it is totally random. But the randomness which invades what people think of as a constructed narrative gives it that energy and the surprisingness. So in other words, what I've tried to do was to turn the randomness of the numbers on the roulette wheel into plot switches.
What mood or what state of mind did you want the casino to embody?
Oh, I think it's like an opium den, really.
The House of Addiction is what the croupier calls it.
It's an opium den. House of Addiction, exactly. You only go there, you mostly go there to enjoy or suffer. You don't go there because it's an interesting thing to do. You go there because you know you're going to lose. So you go there because you want to enjoy yourself suffering, really.
Do you gamble yourself?
No, I don't anymore. I did. Years ago, here in the South of France, actually, I sort of kept myself gambling. I used to go in the mornings.
Why in the mornings?
Well, because nobody's there.
Uh-huh.
So, and the numbers are the same, whoever's there. And if you start gambling with people, you see, 11 o'clock in the morning, well, they used to open at 11. I don't think they do now. But 11 o'clock in the morning, they're still cleaning up, you know, basically. So there's one or two tables open. And there's a couple of people there, you know. And so you're not gambling against any, you don't have any relation to people at all. You're only there against the house, as it were. And what I would do, and I'm very young, I was early 20s, simply I had whatever, 100 francs or something of that kind. And all I wanted to do was to make 50%, which is to make 50 francs, something like that. And when I got there, I would stop. And that would pay my rent or whatever down here for a week or so. You know.
Did you lose more than you made?
No, I won in the end. But won in the end in the sense of, yes, I used to lose. But you have to have a stake that you don't touch, you don't spend.
Right.
You know, whatever, depending on how big a roller you are. You mustn't touch the stake. In other words, you mustn't go into the stake to spend money. You have to keep that as something apart.
If you're gambling at 11 in the morning, then you're not even fooling yourself with the idea that this is glamorous, this is the nightlife.
No, absolutely not. You just want the money. I only wanted the money.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I just needed, I had no job and so forth. I'd been working in Paris with the film director Jean-Pierre Melville, which is my first job in film.
What did you work with him on?
It was a film, it's called, an American title is The Finger Man.
Oh, yeah, that was re-released here a few years ago.
Yeah, it's called Le Doulos in French. And he gave me my first job.
Well, just for our listeners who aren't familiar with him, he's a French director who made a few films like The Finger Man and Le Samurai that are considered real classics of gangster noir films.
Exactly.
And a lot of American directors have been influenced by
him. Yes, Tarantino talks about him a lot and in fact has copied many shots from Melville's films.
While we're on the subject, is there anything that you learned from Melville that you feel you put to work in Croupier?
Oh, yes. I mean, it is deeply influenced, I would say, by him. It was the first job, and I met him in London. Basically, what Melville's films were about, and I don't know how many really have been shown in America, but you certainly know the Doulos and you know Samurai, and you may also know a film called Second Breath. I don't know. What he did was, he made, from 1960s on, gangster movies, set in largely in Paris and in around Marseille and so forth. They were gangster movies that were about betrayal and fidelity. And what I got from him was that betrayal and fidelity, as you know, honor amongst thieves and so forth, that kind of theme, was not really a story necessarily of gangsters, but applied to every aspect of your life, whether it's sexual betrayal with wife or whatever, or leaving your family, or in particular, since Melville was part of the was involved in the resistance in France, that it was really almost a political thing. So the idea of being a loner, of relying on yourself totally, and of your own integrity, set in a kind of gangster milieu, and that stuck with me a lot. And I think there's that sense of independence, being a loner, and so forth, but in a social situation, is very strong in Croupier.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, what kind of work did you do with Jean-Pierre Melville?
Oh, I was a runner, a floor runner. My first job.
So you're like a gopher for him?
Yeah, like a gopher.
But you absorbed a lot.
Oh yes, I was there. I had incredible jobs to do.
Like what?
Well, I tell you, like for example, he came to me and he said, and you know, I had very schoolboy French then, and he came to me and he said, "If you know what the raincoat, the Macintosh that Humphrey Bogart wore in The Barefoot Contessa." I said, "In the Funeral in the Rain." I said, "Yes, I know that coat very well." He says, "I want one for Jean-Paul Belmondo in the film." I said, "Well, that's costume, you know, I don't know." He said, "No, but you know who has one?" I said, "No." He said, "You know, Albert Camus had that very imperméable raincoat." And I said, "Yes, I've seen the pictures of Camus, you know, in the raincoat with the epaulettes and all the flaps and everything, you know, American stuff." He said, "Well, I think, can you see if you can get it?" I said, "But he died 6 months ago in the car crash." He said, "Yeah, but he wasn't wearing the coat," said Melville. "So why don't you get on to his widow and see if the coat's still there? I'd very much like Jean-Paul to wear this coat during the film."
Did you get
it? Imagine.
Did you get it?
Of course not. I found another one ended up in the Place Clichy, and he wore that, and that was fine, but it wasn't. He wanted the one. He couldn't get Bogie's coat, but he wanted the one that Albert Camus...
Did you call the widow?
Oh, yes, but, I mean, there was less like a secretary.
Wow.
I mean, my French, can you imagine? I don't know why he didn't do it himself. I mean, he was famous, and I was absolutely nobody, but...
Did you have to do casino research in order to make Croupier, or had you spent enough time in casinos?
No, I did that research into talking to croupiers.
You did do that?
Mm.
What were some of the things they told you they liked most and really despised most about their work?
They despised the punters, the gamblers. They despised their jobs. They despise everything about the casino. They hate the management. There is nothing they like at all. There are people who are basically socially and personally dysfunctional. They have no proper home lives. They're very often products of divorces and so forth. It's a place, when you become a croupier, at least as far as Europe goes, and I'm sure it's true in America too, it's because you have nowhere else to go. You get away from all kinds of responsibility. You drink, you're on drugs, and after hours, you gamble. You are a completely and utterly corrupt person, I would say. And all the time you think, "I'll just make enough money, and then I'll quit this." And in other words, it's almost a reverse form of gambling. You're as hooked as the punters you despise because they throw away their money, much of it not theirs, a lot of it stolen, often other people's money.
What is the croupier hooked on?
Watching people lose.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a mechanical job, you see. I mean, it doesn't require, it looks very skillful and so forth, but actually, it's a purely mechanical, kind of automaton-like job.
My guest is Paul Myersberg. He wrote the screenplay for Croupier. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest Paul Myersberg wrote the screenplay for the new film Croupier. Without giving anything of the film away, there is a subplot in the movie that is left kind of unresolved. You're not really sure about why something happened, what the cause was.
Yes.
And I will say that when I was leaving the theater, a lot of people in the audience, I was trying to listen to what they were saying, and we were all trapped waiting for this terrible rainstorm to end, so I had plenty of time to overhear. And a lot of people seemed really kind of baffled and a little disturbed that something wasn't completely resolved, and there were a couple of different ways you could interpret it.
Now, are we talking about someone's death?
Yes, we are.
Right, without giving anything
without
away.
Without giving anything away.
No.
So I'm wondering...
Someone's death is... You can look at it in many ways. It's a coincidence, an unpleasant and unhappy circumstance, or it was designed and deliberate for plot reasons. There is no possible way anyone, well, not anyone, the character in our story, our croupier, Jack, can determine what that is. And in a sense, after someone's dead, in a way, it doesn't matter. My point was, or was intended to be, that when you become involved in a world where you get superstitious, where you become, you have a feeling that this number must come up, that this, that there's a plan and a plot and so forth, you also come across the problem of coincidence. You don't know whether a coincidence is part of a design, the origin of which you don't know, or whether it's just a random event. And it seemed to me that what I wanted to do was to show that all events, really, are random. This is not a narrative film, in a sense. I mean, it has no flashbacks, and there's only one intercut scene in the whole movie. Every scene goes from one to the next to the next to the next. There's only one intercut moment. And what I wanted to do was to say, when you get superstitious, when you get frightened, when you get worried, when you owe money, when you've won money, you become, your mind begins to think, there's a meaning to this. Something happened. Somebody caused this. I'm responsible. Whatever. And so what I was really playing with was the, or tickling, I suppose you'd say, was the idea that you can't let anything go once you become hooked on gambling because it's so close to superstition and to witchcraft.
Now, what about you as the writer? Do you know the reasons behind this death, or do you not know either?
Oh, I know.
You know.
Oh, yes, I know.
When the interview's over, you can tell me.
Right.
So I won't
but
be betraying
the thing,
this
at, again, of Hemingway's, you know, the famous remark, you can leave everything out provided you know what it is.
Right, but you think that the writer needs to know, even if the character doesn't.
Absolutely.
The croupier is also a writer, and during most of the movie, he really hasn't written much at all, but he finally does start to write. He gives a draft of his book to his girlfriend, and she doesn't like it.
Yes.
She describes the main character in his book as a miserable zombie, and she says, there's no hope in it.
Yes.
Did you worry at all that people might say that about your movie?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. And in a way, there is no hope in it, because it's a very unreliable guide, hope. You know, that the hope that I meant or was referring to, in a way, is the fact that hope is not really the answer to a miserable existence, you know. And the lottery and the addiction to gambling and so forth, any way out of misery, failure, deprivation, and so forth. Hope is not the way out. The way out is a much more constructive sense of who you are, where you belong. And so to rely on hope with a capital H in a sort of, you know, a Hollywood way, or indeed any way, in almost a rather childish way, is very dangerous because nothing may happen.
That's a really interesting way to look at it, because hope is really sold or oversold in the United States, you know. Hope is...
Well, I think that, yes, it is oversold everywhere, by the way. You know, I mean, what would happen to Erin Brockovich if she didn't get in? You know, it's too horrible to think about, isn't it? What would happen if it all failed? Or I was watching on television the other night, The Verdict. Supposing Paul Newman didn't sober up in time, what then? But you see, there are stories like that which don't have hope in them and are brilliant and very successful. For example, I was thinking, watching The Verdict, and it relates a little bit to this, in a film of Otto Preminger's of about 1959 called Anatomy of a Murder. You know, there, I don't know whether you've seen the film, but in it, a person who is probably guilty gets off by virtue of the law. Probably guilty. This is Ben Gazzara in the story, who murdered a man who apparently raped his wife, Lee Remick. And that stuck with me, that stick with the rules and you'll be fine. Even if they are all wrong, if they let people off who are guilty and even frame people who are innocent, if you haven't got the law, you haven't got anything, and that's got nothing to do with hope. And in the casino, there are iron rules, in a sense. It's corrupt, but there are iron rules. And the only rule is losing. And if you are a winner, you are not allowed back. And it's as simple as that. You can't go back if you win. They bar you, you know, if you constantly win from casinos. Everywhere. In Vegas, everywhere. And I was very intrigued by the idea, do we want the law or do we want hope and belief in truth and justice and so forth? And I finally decided that actually, for all its horrors, the law is better because it works both ways. Hope works no way. It's just, you know, something to do when you're going nowhere, something to feel and so forth. So this was really a hopeless story with a happy ending, in my view.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Paul Myersberg wrote the screenplay for the film Croupier. We'll hear from the director in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House's Crown Publishers Division, hardcover publishers of Patient Number One, a true story of how one CEO took on cancer and big business in the fight of his life, by Rick Murdoch and David Fisher. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, the story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet Mike Hodges, the director of Croupier. His debut film, Get Carter, was a gangland thriller starring Michael Caine. It's considered one of the most influential British crime films.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We just heard from the screenwriter of the new film Croupier about a writer who takes a job as a croupier, returning to the world of casino gambling, the world he was born into but tried to stay away from. Joining us from London is the director of the film, Mike Hodges. He made his film debut in 1971 with Get Carter, a crime film starring Michael Caine. In a British Film Institute survey of film professionals ranking the top 100 British films, Get Carter was number 16. When Terrence Malick saw Hodges' 1974 film, The Terminal Man, he wrote Hodges a letter saying, "I want you to know what a magnificent, overwhelming picture it is." Before we hear from Hodges, let's listen to the opening scene of Croupier.
Now he had become the still center of that spinning wheel of misfortune. The world turned round him, leaving him miraculously untouched. The croupier had reached his goal. He no longer heard the sound of the ball.
What were some of the things that you thought about or tried to do when you were shooting the gambling tables? I think you really captured a sense of the rhythm, of the almost hypnotic rhythm of it, and of the theater, the sense of theater that some croupiers bring to the table, or at least they bring it to the table in the movie.
It's curious, actually, because my experience of casinos, which is pretty limited, but they are completely different in every country. A large part of the presenting, the atmosphere of this of my casino, and in indeed any casino, is actually the use of sound to a large degree. And each casino sounds very different. The American casinos tend to be raucous. The French casinos seem to be like cathedrals. The British casinos are kind of odd, joyless places, actually, as far as I could see. I went and looked at them. And I had, you know, they were not very... not very interesting places to look at visually. And I was on a bus in London. I suddenly remember there was a record store on Oxford Street, and I remembered the staircase going down, which was all mirrors. And I decided that would enhance the kind of the deception of the place, actually, and, of course, the narcissism of the film by actually putting mirrors in the casino. And then I thought, well, this is a terrible cheat because people would be able to see the cars or whatever. But then I went back to various other casinos and did notice that they actually had mirrors. Atmosphere is always important to me in films, and I think part of the secret, actually, of making a film is actually allowing the film to breathe. In other words, allowing the casino to breathe. And I think that a lot of directors rush things too much. You know, to provide that kind of atmosphere and that kind of rhythm, you do need time. But I think that you can slow things down almost hypnotically for audiences anyway. I think you can, you know, you can reduce the speed of a film quite dramatically and still hold attention. I mean, it isn't very voguish these days because everything is for you know, there's so much insecurity shown as filmmaking that I think that one had to hold one's nerve with this film and not be scared of that, actually, and then hope that the allowing the atmosphere to seep into the picture itself would pay off.
You know, you're talking about how in English casinos they're much quieter, they're not raucous like American ones, and the sound motif of the movie, it's the first sound that you hear, and in fact you hear it before you even see anything, is the sound of the ball going around the roulette wheel. Before you know what it is, it almost sounds like a lot of insects for some reason. Was that your idea, to use that sound as a dominant sound?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I heard Paul talking earlier, but that certainly was one of the contributions that I made. It was that if the film was just about a casino and about gambling, it really wouldn't have any resonance at all. So I wanted the casino, in a sense, to resonate throughout his personal life and into the world outside the casino. And to do that, I wanted to take the sound, particularly of the ball rolling round and eventually landing in the number, to take the whole element of chance that is represented in the casino and show that it actually applies to just about every part of our lives. So the sound was indeed very important, and the sound of that ball going round and landing is the first sound of the picture, because in a way that is the picture.
Right.
That is the story we're trying to tell. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. Do you gamble?
Filmmaking is enough for me, actually, no. Although I won on the Grand National this year. No, I've backed that once a year. They're like, no, I'm not a gambler.
Are there things you had to learn about gambling in casinos before making the movie?
I went and looked. It seems to me that you could actually quite rapidly pick up the general gist of what's going on. Again, it's watching the faces and the kind of people that go to casinos. Clive and those actors who were actually playing croupiers all went to a croupier school and became quite proficient. They couldn't, you know, do various highly technical things like stacking the chips and things like that. So they brought a lot with them for me to observe. And in addition, of course, to using other real croupiers, all the other women croupiers, for example, were real croupiers. So I could, you know, in the casino that I built, I could really create my own world and my own casino. And I didn't really, in all honesty, need to know much more than that.
Now, you mentioned the mirrors that you wanted in the casino. What else did you do in the design of the casino to make it easy to shoot the film you wanted to shoot in it?
Oh, well, there was one great big, which was never in the original script, actually, which I couldn't believe it when I went to an actual casino. And I realized that they had these machines, which was a hole in the table where they swept all the chips into this black hole, which then drops down, and they're all sorted by a machine underneath. I mean, the sight of this in the first casino I went to, I just absolutely insisted that all the tables were fitted with this machine, which was a bit of a bore, but in fact for the whole, I just couldn't believe that people would sit down at a table and watch the money literally be pushed down a black hole. It seemed to me that the greatest symbol and metaphor of the film was this awful sort of bottomless pit where the chips went down. The other thing that occurred to me was that when I went to watch the activities in a casino, was that the chip came to represent for me just not just a chip, but it became to represent money, which of course is it you have to pay for it. And then I kept thinking, what have people done to earn the money to buy the chip, which is then disappears down this plug hole? I mean, it was, you know, a daunting sort of moment for me when I realized. I mean, had people been into prostitution? Had they been into, you know, is it dirty money? Had they worked for 100 hours a week to get the money to throw it away? What had they done to earn the money, which they then throw away? It seemed to me an enormously serious moment when I saw this. And I couldn't believe that the casinos had incorporated into their activities, in a sense, this black hole. And of course, I used it mercilessly, I must be honest.
The film Croupier is a Mike Hodges, Paul Myersberg film. And I've heard that you asked for Myersberg's name to be with you in that heading. A lot of directors just get the top billing, you know, themselves. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I have to be honest. You've got a term for it over there with this new credit. Well, it's not a new one. It's been going on for, I don't know, 30 years. Where, I mean, people who are not even known to anybody get a credit right up the top of the picture. I don't really like that. I think filmmaking is such a collaborative business. If I'd written the script myself, fine, it then could be a Mike Hodges film, but I couldn't possibly have taken it and called it a Mike Hodges film when Paul's involvement and the script is so good that I couldn't possibly take that as a credit. I have to say, I did it once before with a Tom Stoppard thing, a television piece that I did called Squaring the Circle in the 80s, and it was a Mike Hodges film, you know, my contract, but I insisted it was called a Mike Hodges and Tom Stoppard film. But I'm not sure this credit is, I don't know, I wish we could get rid of it, to be honest with you.
Why?
Well, I think there's only certain directors. I mean, from a box office point of view, I think there are only certain directors that really count very much. From Hitchcock, obviously. I just think that it is a collaborative venture. You get the credit you deserve at the end, it seems to me, as the director.
My guest is Mike Hodges, director of the film Croupier. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mike Hodges, and he directed the new film Croupier. Your first movie, Get Carter, which came out in 1971, is about to come out on DVD. It stars Michael Caine as a professional killer who sets out to avenge the murder of his brother in Newcastle. Pauline Kael said, in praise, I think, there's nobody to root for but the smartly dressed sexual athlete and professional killer in this gangland picture, which is so calculatedly cool and soulless and nastily erotic that it seems to belong to a new genre of virtuoso viciousness. Now, you adapted the movie from a novel by Ted Lewis. You wrote the screenplay and you directed it. Why did you choose this kind of really nasty story for your first film?
Well, partly I was sent the novel. It was the first time I was ever offered a feature film. So there was that element. I would have to admit to ambition. And I would also have to admit to the fact that I, during the 60s, I'd worked on a program called World in Action, which is kind of like your 60 Minutes. Only we would do just one item. And I'd really seen the underbelly of life just about everywhere. I went to, went to Vietnam. I was in Dallas in 1964 doing a program with the Maisel brothers on Barry Goldwater as the Republican nominee. I'd done a program on Freemasonry, which had been banned in my own country because most of the board of directors turned out to be Freemasons, which, not surprising, so it never got out on the air. And I just had basically observed in my own country a great deal of hypocrisy and a great deal of corruption. And we always had such a grand view of ourselves. Our police were wonderful. It was American cops. It was, that were corrupt. And there was no such thing as corruption here. And all of that changed, really, in the late 60s when we had some unbelievably vicious villains, basically some criminals, the Cray brothers and the Richardson brothers. So when I was offered this film, whilst I would readily admit that I took it on because it was my break into feature films, I took it on also because I could make a film that I thought would try to show a completely different side to the British character. Most of the, a lot of the elements in Get Carter were based obviously on the novel. But then when I chose where to shoot it, which was in Newcastle, which I'd sailed into when I was doing my national service in the Royal Navy on a minesweeper on the lower deck, again, I saw, the real underbelly of my country. So I went back to Newcastle where I set the story. The novel wasn't set there at all, or it wasn't really set anywhere. And I found that there was a similar story, which I then began to investigate, of a hitman being sent up there and so on. So the house at the end is a real villain's house. It had never been used since the criminal had done a bunk to the belly to Spain. And the place was, so all of the, many of the elements in Get Carter were based on a factual story. And it is a cruel film, you're quite right. But I decided that if I was going to make it, it would have to be as ruthless as I could make it, actually.
Now, I should mention, this placed 16 on the top 100 British films in a survey of movie professionals. So it obviously has had a real big impact on British filmgoers and British filmmakers, even though not that many people in America are familiar with the movie, though I think, many are, but not that many.
Right, no, of course not.
No one is redeemed at the end of this movie. There's no moral resolution. Did that suit you as a filmmaker?
Again, I think that that you have to be as honest. If you're going to take on a story like that, you have to be as honest to it as I say I was to something like Flash Gordon, which is the opposite end of the spectrum. I mean, Flash Gordon is truthful to its source. Actually, it is a strip cartoon on film. So I think that that when you're dealing with people like Carter and the people that he uncovered when he goes north to that town of Newcastle, none of those people are redeemable. It's interesting. There is a remake being made with Sylvester Stallone, which I'm now told is a redemption movie. So it's very interesting that
figures.
There's more money in redemption, I think, to be honest with you. I couldn't possibly. The thing that I did insist on, which they tried to talk me out of, was is Carter's demise at the end of the film, and that I absolutely insisted on. And it was always in the original script, and I never wavered from that moment. And that he had to be dismissed in exactly the same way as that he dismissed all the other people who got in between him and his revenge. And that I would not deviate from.
Why?
Because I thought that the justice was there. It was built-in justice. I do believe that your life ends up much the way that you lived it. So Carter had lived by violence, and he would end violently. I mean, it's not always the case, but it is to a large degree, I think.
Michael Caine is really terrific in Get Carter. His body language and his speech are so perfect. And he's obviously a really cold guy, but he could turn on the charm. He could be funny in a really nasty way. And there are those moments where you can tell that there is some kind of heart beating underneath all of that. Let me play a short clip from the movie. In this scene, the Michael Caine character, the hitman, has just gotten to Newcastle. He's gotten there in time to see his brother laying in state before the cremation, and now he's going to avenge his brother's death. So one of his first stops is at a racetrack where he finds someone who he assumes is in on his brother's murder. His name is Eric. He's wearing a chauffeur uniform, and Michael Caine's trying to see what he's up to. And, of course, Eric is a little concerned about Michael Caine having come by.
I would be, too.
Yeah.
So who are you working for these days, Eric?
Oh, I'm straight. Respectable.
What are you doing? Advertising martini.
Oh, you've been watching television?
Yeah. Come off it, Eric. Who is it? Brumby? Kinnear?
What's it to you, anyway?
Well, I've always had your welfare at heart, Eric. Besides which, I'm nosy.
Well, that's not always a healthy way to be, is it?
And you should know, if I remember rightly. So, you're doing all right then, Eric. You're making good.
Making a living.
Good prospects for advancement, is there? A pension? Do you know, I had almost forgotten what your eyes looked like.
They're still the same. Piss holes in the snow.
Still got a sense of humour.
Yeah. Yes, I retain that, Eric.
Well, that was a scene from Mike Hodges' first film, Get Carter, made in 1971. You were so lucky to have Michael Caine to work with in your first film, and then you worked with him again in your movie Pulp. How did you get to work with Michael Caine?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've always been kept slightly in the dark about this. I had done two television films. One was called Suspect and one was called Rumour. And they both got a lot of coverage, and I had a lot of freedom as a writer-director in those days. And they'd obviously been noticed by a producer whose name is Michael Klinger. He had the rights to Ted Lewis's book. And the book was sent to me and I was asked if I would like to write and direct it. I said yes. I then wrote the script before I'd chosen the location at all. So I wrote a draft of the script. And I'd always, my two films on television, no one had ever asked me, can you believe it these days, but no one had ever asked me who the actors were going to be. I chose the actors. No one ever, that's how it was in those days. Absolutely extraordinary. There was no interest in names or whatever. The story was good. You could make the film. There was no, you know. So I hadn't really thought in terms of I just thought of actors, never of film stars. And I had finished the draft, and patently what had happened was that Michael Caine had been interested in working with me and on this project, but was really not going to, his name was not going to be mentioned, I suspect, until the script was written. And when he read the script, then he came and said he would like to do it to the producer, who then relayed this information to me. I mean, I was astonished, of course.
Did you learn things about acting and directing actors from watching Michael Caine act and directing him?
Oh, well, you could not. I mean, I'd worked with actors before, but Caine's technique was impeccable, I must say. His knowledge of filmmaking was impeccable. I have to say that that Clive Owen is much the same. It's this kind of extraordinary sense of filmmaking. So the hitting of the marks and the understanding of what the camera is actually doing was amazing. And, of course, I was pushing Michael, because if you look at Carter, there are scenes in there, again, for example, there was this one scene in his landlady's room he rents in Newcastle, where he brings a character back and then he interrogates him, and there's a bottle of whiskey and so on. And I shot all of that scene in one. Now, and a lot of it on Michael Caine's back. And I sort of, looking back, I had a lot of chutzpah, actually, because you'd been led to believe that stars wanted preferential treatment and they wanted their close-ups and so on. Michael was never like that. So I could do things with him that I probably wouldn't be able to do with other major stars. So in that sense, I was terribly lucky. And I was allowed that kind of freedom. He went with me completely in the way that I wanted to direct the film.
My guest is Mike Hodges. His new film is called Croupier. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mike Hodges. He directed the British film Croupier, which recently opened in American theaters. What was there a type of movie that made a particularly big impression on you when you were growing up?
Well, it was interesting. I lived in a provincial town in England, and my parents frowned upon the cinema to a large degree anyway. And there were three cinemas there. And in those days, you used to have two films. You had an A film and a B film. And I was always slipping away from whatever to my home to go to the movies. And I often found that the B movies, the American B movies, I enjoyed more than the more portentous A movies. So I did watch a lot of those B movies. Not all of them were good. In fact, a lot of them were quite bad. But I just liked the sort of, again, I liked the simplicity. They were, there were conveyor belt movies. The director just was given a script on the Monday morning. He went in there and he'd given his cast and he went in and did it. But there was a kind of precision and a professionalism about the way they were made and the way that the story unfolded that I just loved. And of course, a lot of them were carrying, you know, strong political messages, actually, strong social messages. So I became very obsessed by using thrillers to carry the social message. I mean, Carter is an interesting film in a sense that it reveals a lot about the class structure here. It reveals a lot about the anger that comes from that situation. If I spent two years on the lower deck you know, with seamen. I was an only national serviceman on a minesweeper and, you know, going around the fishing ports of England and up to the Arctic. You saw an incredible amount of anger amongst on the lower deck, where you had the archetypal class society, where the officers were in the wardroom and we were on the lower deck. And I came from a totally different background to most of the people on the lower deck, and it changed my life forever, frankly. It was my education, my university, without a shadow of a doubt.
You've made comparatively few movies in your career. Is there an explanation for that?
Well, you know, if you want to make hard films, if you want to make films that don't have obvious commercial potential, then it's quite difficult to get. I mean, it's been partly that I started creating, you know, writing and directing my own movies, and then I did various adaptations, but I'd always controlled what I made. And I struggled. I was, by the end of, after The Terminal Man, in the latter part of the 70s, I lost that. I was 4 years trying to set up a particular project which I'd written, and I couldn't do it. And the 80s were a sort of bumpy ride in terms of just keeping my fingers in the pot at all. And then I made another film called Black Rainbow in the early 90s, which is a film that I wrote and directed with Rosanna Arquette and Jason Robards, which again, you know, had terrible distribution. So I just had a sort of, it isn't from choice, you know, but I am a slow turning round and deciding what I want to do next. But it's been fate to a large degree. It's a bit like being in the croupier.
Yeah, right. Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Not at all, Terry. Okay. It's been nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you. Thank you so much. Mike Hodges directed the British film Croupier, which is now showing in many American theaters. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Helen Wong. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide. At www.alcatel.com. From Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division, publisher of Fierce Invalids Home from Hot Climates, the new novel by Tom Robbins. And from Putumayo World Music, presenting Miriam Makeba's new recording, Homeland and South African Legends, a collection featuring Johnny Clegg, Hugh Masekela, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, and others. Information at www.putumayo.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Michael Ondaatje joins us to talk about Anil's Ghost, his first novel since The English Patient. It's set during a civil war in Sri Lanka, where he grew up. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.